Hi, my name is Louise and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Louise.
And I apologize to those of you who've heard me several times. I'm Sandy's backup speaker. it's true when he says we met 27 years ago. I was hanging around AA, but for the grace of God, I've been sober for 31 years, which is kind of a miracle. I don't know. I just stayed. You know, that's the one thing I did is I stayed. I didn't leave. And sometimes I have a tendency to not want to go to meetings because I go, well, I've been in this long. I need it. Geez, I'm cured. And I start getting really stinking thinking and the poor me's and the whole world's against me very quickly. I even caught myself. The last month I've been working on a project with work and, oh, I can't get to a meeting, can't get to my home group, can't get to... And then, you know, I was feeling so sorry for myself, a bunch of things, that all of a sudden, ping, you know, I'm hanging around, people are drinking wine, and geez, you know, that kind of looks good. And I'm never cured, you know. I'm the kind of alcoholic, I guess, that I have alcoholic thinking. It's never going to go away from my experience, that unless I work my steps and stay close to the program, the quality of my life is diminished, and also, you know, the temptation and the possibility of picking up a drink is, you know, is right there. So Sandy, I went to a meeting last night where Sandy was speaking, so he's getting even with me. And the really cool thing is I ended up going downtown to the 10 o'clock meeting, the young people's meeting, and I didn't even know it existed. And I got such a kick out of it because it was such a nice energy to see people. Because I came in, I guess, fairly young, 22, you know, and, you know, people would laugh or they'd say, oh, you know. And I remember thinking, there was a young people's group called the Yes Group, and we were about 10 people. And we were very busy being young and sober, and it was fun, you know. But at most of the groups, it was older men. And I don't know, like my first meeting, the meeting I went to last night was at, it's where Wednesday Noon is too, on St. Catherine. And that's where I went to my very first meeting. And so it has a special place in my heart when I go in that room, you know, I think, wow, you know, that's, and I was fortunate enough to not pick up another drink since then. But, you know, I'm going to go back a bit and tell you my story. You may not relate to the details of my story because I came in young. I was a binge drinker. I never became a daily drinker, or I haven't become a daily drinker so far yet, you know, but for the grace of God. And so, you know, but I think emotionally we can all relate, you know, if the details. I grew up on the West Island in Point Claire, and already my upbringing was schizophrenic. You know, I was in an English community and I went to French school. So in the English community we were frogs, and in the French community we were, you know, the tight coddy, and so I never, you know, never quite fit in. And we went to church. Church was a big, big deal, you know, French Catholic, the nuns and the whole bit, and, you know, confession. And so I grew up feeling very scared, in a way, of God, and very repentant and guilty. And I remember, you know, in those days we had to go to the confessional, and well, I guess people still go today, but we don't. But anyway, the confessional, and I remember feeling like always playing games with God, you know, going like, okay, I disobeyed my mother. I'll tell the priest it was 300 times. And then I'll add 301, I'll add a lie in there just to be safe so I don't burn in hell, you know. And, you know, it was like fear-based stuff. And by the time I hit 12 years old, I just went, you know, the cover of Time magazine said God was dead. And I just went, fuck that, I'm not going back to church. And already in my house there was a lot of discord. Unbeknownst to me, like, my dad was a drinker, and it was very well hidden. My uncle didn't do such a good job of hiding it, though. Like, he was the big drunk in the family, so compared to him, my dad was pretty good, you know? And there were lots of stories about my uncle, you know, coming over loaded, and I'd, you know, go in the bathroom, there was booze in the bathroom tank, and he was quite a character. He's in the vets right now, and I was speaking to him on the phone the other day, and he said, "Louise, I've got a year in. I've got a year in. A year of not drinking." You know, because he knows I'm in the program. So he's been, you know, saying this to me, but he's locked in a ward. <You know? laughs> Although these guys, they manage the vets. So they manage to take cabs and go down to St. Anne's and get drunk. And the odd thing is that my neighbor is his psychologist, and my neighbor would have this look on his face, go, "Your uncle's being inappropriate again." I said, "Oh, he's probably drunk. Has he been going down to the village again?" You know. So I lived with this all my life. My poor mom, both her brother and sister are alcoholics, and she was, and then she marries an alcoholic, and my father, you know, was a very good provider, so it was never really a case of saying, you know, he neglected us in any way. But, in fact, he just got wealthier and wealthier the more he drank, you know, which was very bizarre because, you know, see, he had a lot of denial. And he ended up dying sober because he couldn't drink, you know. Anyway, that's another story, but... So I grew up around alcoholism, and it's on both sides of my family. They're French and Irish. And in fact, I went to Ireland a couple of years ago, and I looked up my mother's side of the family, and I went with my daughter, and we found the little town where they were from, which was actually Tipperary, oddly enough. And just as I rented a car, and I'm driving by, and this car stops me. It's like 3 in the afternoon, and this man comes over, and he's completely drunk, you know. And he says, "Where the fuck am I?" You know, he says, "I've been drinking all day. I don't give a fuck." And I thought, okay, this is where my relatives are from. And when I went into the town, there were a few establishments with their name on it that were broken down. I took pictures. It was like, oh, boy, you know. So I do believe that it's, you know, I don't know if it's the Irish disease or whatever, but... that there's certainly a genetic component. And it doesn't seem to hit everybody, but I can definitely say that there's alcoholism in my family, you know, both sides. And also as well, you know, manic depression, you name it. So my mom, you know, held it together. We were 7 kids, and my mother, as a teenager, she started going to Al-Anon. So, you know, the only reason I have to thank my mom for my being in the program this long is because she did go to Al-Anon, and she did help me. And, yeah, I saw a big change in my mother, you know, because it was very difficult. I left home when I was 17. Like, the minute I hit 17, I just wanted to get the hell out of there. And I lived downtown. I was going to school. I was in acting and theater. So it was a great place to... you know, it's like I'd be somebody else. I didn't have to be myself. But the problem was when I got off stage at, you know, just school productions, I would get completely drunk, you know, and mix it with drugs. And so it became like when I came in the program, I stopped doing that altogether because I was too, like, I don't want to go there, you know. I don't want to deal with stage fright by getting drunk afterwards. And I wouldn't be the only person doing that, that's for sure. But, so I'm kind of rambling all over the place, but yeah, so I was living downtown with a bunch of, teenagers, you know, going drinking and partying, and I was, you know, good old times. But when they drank, you know, they seemed to stop, and when I drank, I got into really bad situations. You know, I was blacking out. I started blacking out when I was 16, even 17. You know, so right from the get-go, and I drank to get drunk. I drank hard liquor. It was like, okay, move forward. And I remember guys that I knew saying, "Oh, my God, you know, like, I really should slow down. You really shouldn't drink such hard liquor." Like, the guys, you know, being worried about me. And I was like, you know, watch out. And what would happen is I would get really sick and then do crazy things, and you know the story. So what I did is I started trying to control it. Like, I knew that if I drank at school that people would see me, and I tried to control it. So I hung around a lot of people who drank, and my brother was dealing drugs. So it was, you know, that kind of environment. And a lot of people do indulge in that stuff when they're teenagers. And so I think a lot of my family thought, oh, what am I talking about when I came into AA, you know, but they didn't see a lot of where I ended up, you know. And it was scary because I felt suicidal. That was sort of part of it when I drank and afterwards. At one point, you know, I took a geographical cure when I was 19. I went to Mexico to go to school. And I could have had a scholarship and stayed longer, but I was more interested in the marijuana they had there. And I took a lot of risks because I knew girls that were in jail down there for, like, you know, 8-10 years, and I didn't care, you know. I didn't care if I got caught. I didn't care. And it was, you know, just a very kind of suicidal approach to life and drinking, of course. And I sort of blew all my opportunities. So again, you know, I'd have all these guys that I knew would go, boy, you sure don't know how to stop, eh? Like, it was embarrassing. Anyway, you know, there's drugs in my story. But what happened even at that age, I was trying to control it all the time. Because at 16, I'd been diagnosed with diabetes, but hypoglycemia, which is, it's basically like diabetes, you know, it's... Because I kept feeling really sick, and I think it was because I had hangovers. But I got diagnosed with this condition, which I still have today, which means that I am not supposed to have coffee, anything that's a stimulant, alcohol, drugs, white flour, white sugar. You know, so for me, it was like a death sentence when I was 16. You know, come on, what are you talking about? And I couldn't make the correlation, you know, like I couldn't even begin to think how I would ever accomplish that, to not drink or do stuff, you know. Like, anyway, you know, that followed me because I'd get sick and then I'd go home and then I go to the doctors and then I try to straighten out, and you know, so I knew, like, I always knew when I was drinking that I wasn't supposed to be drinking. You know, and it had a bad effect on my blood sugar. I'd pass out, and I'd, you know, it's really lucky that I didn't kill myself or didn't die, or, you know, some of the scrapes I got into. So anyway, long story short, I ended up home at my parents', which was very humiliating at the age of 22. And my mom sat me down, and she said, I think you should go to a 12-step program. Just pick any program. You know, and I kept opening my purse, and I'd find all these pamphlets from Al-Anon and AA everywhere, and I get really angry, you know. But eventually I started reading, they have this little thing called One Day at a Time, and just for today. Oh, I saw that everywhere. She was shoving them everywhere, just for today. Al-Anon, you know. And but I had to admit that my mom had changed a lot. She wasn't as resentful. She let my dad deal with his own, you know, he had a huge car accident, drunk, I suppose, you know, and it was really, you know, he had came close a couple of times, and she didn't cover for him anymore. And so it started to become apparent that he had a problem. Anyway, it was a big, big mess, and then anyway, I decided to, you know, what the hell, I might as well try, you know, and I joined AA. I also am in OA, Overeaters Anonymous, to help me stay off of sugar and overeating, and that's not easy, one day at a time. But I went to both programs, and when I remember going to my first AA program, I said, I'm a compulsive overeater. My first AA meeting, everybody burst out laughing. They'd never even heard of an eating disorder. Like, they were looking at me like, and I thought, screw them, I'm going to stay here. This is going to help me. I knew that if I also did AA, it would help me. But I also knew I was a drunk, you know. And so my first meeting at that group, at that church, the guy that was speaking had murdered somebody. And, you know, I hear people say, well, they couldn't identify. I thought, I know exactly how he feels. I thought I'd come close to wanting to murder myself, my parents, you know. Because when I'd be coming off of something, oh my God, I mean. So anyway, I was downtown, I was 22, and I started doing meetings, and I loved it. I just felt like, okay, this is like the piece that's been missing in my life. Especially the spiritual part, because I had thrown all of that away. I had done some TMs and transcendental meditation, and I was searching. I was always searching and looking for something. And I think even with the alcohol, I was all, and certainly drugs, I was looking to, for, you know, I was looking to get high. I was looking to transcend my problems, and I was always a super nervous person, worried a lot. You know, worried a lot, very, and I still today, you know, I can get really anxious over stupid stuff, and I have to turn it over. I just have to, you know, let it go. And so, you know, for me, like drinking, doing drugs, was, finally this stupid committee in my head would shut up, you know, and so I've had to learn how to do that sober. At first, when I came to the program, I did not 90 meetings in 90 days, because I never did anything, you know, just halfway. I had to do 180 meetings in 180 days, right? And it was great. I loved it. I just loved it. And I don't know. It's just but for the grace of God. What can I say? You know, like I had friends. I remember thinking I had about 3 years that I was sick of it. I had enough. And I was always like, if you keep going to meetings, then you meet somebody who's gone out on a slip for you, you know? And I saw people who went out on slips, and I say, for me, I look at this as a selfish program. You know, I was told this is a selfish program. It's a recovery program. You got to do everything you have to get well, because it's life and death. And I know that, because I know that should I drink again or do drugs again, I'd probably kill myself, you know? I'd be probably so humiliated. Not to say that, you know, there wouldn't be a chance to come back, but I don't know that. I don't know that. And as far as I'm concerned, life is tough enough without putting that into the mix, you know. Anyway, those first few years in the program really have stood me in good stead. And I have to say, the one thing that I did do is I went to a lot of big book studies and 12-step groups. Over and over and over and over, you know. And I did my fourth and fifth step over and over, you know. I think I'm ready for another one at this point. And then I, you know, got to a point where it was like, okay, I got to start living and get, you know, so I started going to university and I got a few degrees together, and then I met my husband in the program at a conference, and we're divorced today, but he's still in the program, and we're on good terms. And, you know, I used to think, oh, what's going to become of me when I first came into AA? Like, oh, Christ, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in these, you know, living in a catacomb with all these people, these, you know, people that you wouldn't always normally mix with. Let's face it, okay. And I had to like train myself whenever I thought that way that it was the disease speaking, and that thought leads to me wanting to pick up a drink. Okay, the thought that tells me, oh, you don't need to go to your home group, or you don't need to do any service, or you don't, come on. how long have you been sober? You're doing great. Whether it's 3 months or 30 years, who the hell cares? You know, it's that thinking, that con job in my head that tells me it's okay. And I have a tendency to be like this with just about everything, because the steps tell me I have to practice these principles in all my affairs. Well, it's okay to practice them at a meeting where it's, you know, it's kind of fun. We all care about each other and everything. But at home is another story. And, you know, that's where I see my character defects over and over and over again. And I feel grateful, because I feel that, you know, I was talking to Sandy last night. I feel like I'm starting over. You know, it never gets stale. It's just my thinking if I start making excuses, because it's an adventure. It's a spiritual journey, right? And there's always going to be something for me to work on. It seems like a never-ending process. Like, I deal with this and then that addiction. And then I can easily be a shopaholic. I can easily get addicted to relationships, you name it, work. In the last month, work has sort of took, all of a sudden became all important, and I started skipping meetings. So I'm an excessive person. I have to watch it. And I have to watch it, too, and I have to tell myself it's time to go to bed, you know, because I'd stay up all night. I really am not somebody that likes to be told what to do or follow a routine, you know. So, and I realized lately that big character defect, the reason I get resentment so easily is because my ego's so fragile, you know, the ego like this and the insecurity, like what that expression is, but I have both. So if you criticize me, my ego's hurt, because basically I feel worthless and insecure. So much is at stake. And then I get a resentment. And I'm realizing lately that, and I've realized it before, that, you know, the more I'm spiritually fit, the less I take offense. And it's taking offense. You know, I'm deciding to take offense because somebody else says something silly or that I disagree with or I find hurtful. That's their problem. But I take offense. I choose to take offense. And I will go over it and how dare they and should not have talked to me that way. And it's like, well, who am I? You know, like Queen of Sheba. I mean, come on. And so there's a little kid in there that has to just go, big deal. What matters in the end is my relationship with myself, with my higher power and with others. And if, you know, I kept thinking, like, if only I do this, then I'll have some self-worth. If only I do that, I'll have some self-worth. If I achieve this, you know. And in some ways, I've achieved some nice things, you know, job-wise. I have 2 children, and I'm more or less okay. But in a twinkling of an eye, I can think, I'm worthless, I'm no good, and I don't know what I'm trying to say, but what it really matters is that, I guess in the end, what AA taught me is that to choose a higher power that loves me unconditionally with my defects, you know, that I'm not God, I don't have to be perfect. Yeah, I have things that are wrong with me, but I also have good things, and that's what I need to focus on, and I need to get out of self. And myself will just go like, oh, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just my son's a bit like this, and he doesn't seem to be addictive, but he can get on these mental things. And I just said to him the other night, I said, don't listen to your head. Go to bed. Don't listen to your head. You'll be different tomorrow, you'll see, because he wasn't feeling well. I'm just like, oh, things are terrible. You know, and it's like, honestly, a good night's sleep, you know, that goes away. But I do believe it's an illness. I do believe that I will never drink. For me, I'll never eat like a normal person, and I'll never drink like a normal person. And I can honestly say that I'm almost grateful for that, because I love the program. I love the people in the program. And I have a way of dealing with problems on an everyday basis. I don't always do it, believe me. You know, I have all these fantastic tools. I just have to pick them up. Just have to be willing to be willing. You know? And I'm the kind of person that's like, I'll forget about the prayer and meditation. I don't need to do that today. I find that, you know, if I put a little bit of effort in every single day, just if it comes automatically, the prayer, the serenity prayer, this prayer, that's not Sandy, by the way, that picture. That this prayer in particular in the 12-step book has got me through a lot of scrapes, because it tells me stop thinking about yourself. Get out of yourself. And I was talking last night at the meeting. I had a really bad week, like 2 weeks ago. And I'm an English teacher. I teach drama. And so I got back into theater, but as a playwright, you know. And but there's some pretty dysfunctional people in theater, believe me. And I was just working on a production, and oh my God. God help me, you know, it took a lot of serenity, and luckily one of the actors was in the program, and we just both said we're so lucky to have a program. This director, he could really use a program, you know, and he doesn't even have an addiction, poor guy. So I would, you know, but the point is, I had a really bad week. I mean, it started with, I was supposed to go up north. And I borrowed my mother's car, and I packed up my daughter, and then we got a flat tire, right when we were just about to leave. And I wasn't feeling well, and the next day I woke up, and I had bronchitis. So I had to go to the doctors, and I couldn't even deal with the tire. Then I found out a member who I was hoping to go visit in the hospital died. And that was upsetting. And then I found out the same day my sponsor had breast cancer. And, you know, it's not happening to me, but you'd think it was. You know, everything is how I, you know, like I'm not the one. And then this was my week off. Every morning at 7 in the morning, they're pounding down the basement. Loud, loud, loud. Either they're putting in tiles and ripping it out and going, look, I have earplugs on. I can still hear them. And I just wanted to say something, but they're both members. You know, I thought that's not cool. Like, I'm not going to say anything. And so I had to go like, okay, this is a really bad week. And then my daughter got diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And I had to withdraw from school that week and reapply. And that's been really difficult, you know. And again, it's like, I don't accept this. I had planned this nice week in the country. Somebody gave me their cottage. It's not the way it's supposed to go, right? And I'm sick, and I've got earplugs, and I now have to go to a funeral, and it's like, and my daughter said to me, she said, you know, Mom, your friend that just died is a lot worse off than you. I said, yeah, you're right. You're right. And I thought, you know, maybe God's trying to tell me something. There was a big screw in the tire, and I said, I got screwed, you know, like, you know, and slow down, get to a meeting. Why is all this other stuff so important? And so I was able to do that. And, you know, it just, because I'll start going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, and reacting to everything. If I'm spiritually fit and going to meetings, I don't react to everything in such a, you know, because I have a temper. I definitely have a temper. And that temper can get me into a lot of problems. I usually only show it at home. Some of my close friends have seen it. And people I've been in relationships with. And that's when I've had enough. And boom, you know. I almost beat up my father once, you know, and this is in sobriety, okay? And that's how out of control I can get. Because everything's building and building and building. And if I'm not going to take a drink, if I'm not going to overeat, if I'm not going to oversex or whatever it is, or go shopping and spend a whole tons of money, I'm going to get angry. You know, it's not fair. Life should not be this way. And, you know, wow, it's not a pretty thing to see about yourself. You know, it's not a pretty thing to see. I with my kids, I've had to make amends. They'll go, Mom, get to a meeting. And, you know, I don't, that doesn't happen all the time. It happens once in a while. But I have to be very careful. We were talking about this last night, not to blow up at work. So that ability, if I keep it in check and I do the things I need to do on a daily basis, such as take care of my physical health, get some steam off by exercising, by eating properly, getting to meetings, chances are I'm not going to do that, you know? And to me, like, that being that out of control means the next step is drinking or drugging or whatever it is, you know? And I've had moments with my kids where they've really been scared of me, you know? And it's not good. Just recently, I'll stop talking in a minute, my daughter, like, I'm having to deal with this situation where my daughter's sick, and it's not what I wanted. I didn't ask for this. It's not what I signed up for, and of course it's not what she signed up for. She's 17. She started CEGEP. She did 2 weeks. She wants to be an engineer, and she has this stupid illness. And the prognosis is usually about 3 to 4 years before you recover. And I'm trying, I'm like, you know, trying to find alternative methods and cures and everything. And she, you know, she just went to spend a week with her dad. He lives in Ontario. And she emailed me. She said, Mom, could you just stop trying to control me? Could you just accept that I'm sick and let go? Let me rest. And I realized that I can't control this. And that's what I do, you know, like in daily life situations, flat tire. It's a stupid example, but those are the kinds of things I freak out about. And a big thing like this, you know, where she's sick, it's sad. I feel sad a lot, you know, about it. And, you know, it takes her 3 to 4 days of rest to maybe to even go out and do an activity. And then she's even more tired. And it's a bitch, you know. It's not a fun illness to have. So, you know, and she's very discouraged. She'll say, Mom, I'm going to be sick for 3 or 4 years or whatever. And I go, we don't know that. One day at a time. So at home, I try to use the program. I'm trying to use the program, and so we've been emailing. She's at my dad's, and she called. My dad's at my ex. Well, that's a phrase. So I'm at my ex-husband's, and and then finally she said, "Can you let go? You know, can you just let go and accept the situation and stop? You know." And so that's all I could do, you know, let go and let God, eh? Like, things don't always happen the way we want them to. And that's a challenge. I think I've been talking, like, way too long. I'm really grateful to have had a chance to talk because I haven't been going to meetings all that much. And it reminds me, you know, how grateful I am, you know, that no matter what, you know, how busy we get with life, and the bottom line is don't drink. Come to meetings and pray, you know, and that's what I was told over and over and over again. And I've been in sticky situations where people have, you know, have booze in my face and this and that, and I have to remember, it's just like brainwashing, really. Don't drink, come to meetings and pray, don't pick up a drug. It's going to get better, and one of the expressions I like is, not just for today, but this too shall pass. No matter how bad it is, it's not going to make it better. If I pick up. Anyway, thank you very much for letting me speak.